Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Jean-Paul Sartre, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 2.
We've been following Jean-Paul Sartre as he presents his ideas in a public lecture on an October afternoon in 1945. His whole intent is to offer a philosophy that might stimulate post-war social and political reform. He says, each person must become involved, recognize his radical freedom, and assume responsibility for his choices. But Sartre has to say more than this. Where is the distinctively social message? Of course, there can be no social program as such, not for an existentialist. Any detailed plan of action will have to be worked out creatively in the teeth of events. But Sartre thinks that existentialism does have some implications for social critique and social action. At the end of the lecture, we find him trying to reconcile his existentialist philosophy of freedom with his personal commitment to revolutionary social change. This synthesis is a task he'll return to again and again over the years. In the first place, Sartre says, even though we begin with the individual human subject, existentialism isn't mere subjectivism, nor does it advocate sheer anarchy. We're in fact dependent on others. We simply have to determine how we will respond to this situation. Even if human beings are first and foremost individual existences, they still share some things in common.
Even if it is impossible to find in every man some universal essence, which would be human nature, yet there does exist a universal human condition. It's not by chance that today's thinkers speak more readily of man's condition than of his nature. By condition, they mean the general limits which outline man's fundamental situation in the universe. Historical situations vary. A man may be born a slave in a pagan society, or a feudal lord, or a proletarian. What does not vary is the necessity for him to exist in the world, to be at work there, to be there in the midst of other people, and to be mortal there. The limits are neither objective nor subjective, or rather, they have an objective and a subjective side. Objective because they are to be found everywhere and are recognizable everywhere. Subjective because they are lived and are nothing if man does not live them, that is, freely determine his existence with reference to them.
So there is a human condition. Therefore, Sartre suggests that there's a basis for a kind of ethics which we can apply to ourselves and our fellows. There's a kind of moral critique which can have social force. Even if we can't prescribe conduct, we can still assess people's honesty in what they choose to say and do.
If we have defined man's situation as a free choice, with no excuses and no recourse, every man who takes refuge behind the excuse of his passions, every man who sets up a determinism, is a dishonest man.
Even if we choose to be dishonest, we must see that this is what we're doing. There's a kind of moral force which is inescapable here. Even though we're condemned to invent values, we don't invent them all. Some values are implied in our human condition itself, in the very necessity to invent. If it's true that we're free, then we can't cover it up without living a falsehood, without being dishonest. In a perfectly objective sense, then, we'll be trying to deny what we are. We will be inauthentic human beings.
Therefore, I may pass judgment on those who seek to hide from themselves the complete arbitrariness and the complete freedom of their existence. Those who hide their complete freedom from themselves out of a spirit of seriousness or by means of deterministic excuses, I shall call cowards. Those who try to show that their existence was necessary when it is the very contingency of man's appearance on earth, I shall call slobs, or even cads.
Sartre is giving a kind of existentialist sermon. Some people simply go along with life, or they imagine that they're required to do what they do by some external standard. Worse yet, some people explicitly hide behind their circumstances. Sartre says they're all cowards. People who invented an historical plan to give their existence a kind of necessity and purpose, like many religious people and many Marxists, are slobs. The French word here is salaud. Even the sound of the word says it. Salaud. Slobs. They may choose to be slobs, but that's what they are. They're contemptible. They haven't awakened to the radical contingency of human life. But there's even more to it than this. Freedom isn't merely our condition, it's our fundamental value, as Sartre puts it.
Though the content of ethics is variable, a certain form of it is universal.
Existentialism's not merely the basis for a moral critique, it's also the basis for a social ideal, the ideal of freedom everywhere.
Of course, freedom, as the definition of man, does not depend on others, but as soon as there is involvement, that is, as soon as I recognize and affirm my freedom, I am obliged to want others to have freedom at the same time that I want my own freedom. I can take freedom as my goal only if I take that of others as a goal as well. Consequently, when in all honesty I have recognized that man is a being in whom existence precedes essence, that he is a free being who, in various circumstances, can want only his freedom, I have at the same time recognized that I can want only the freedom of others.
Here, finally, is the social message Sartre wants his audience to hear. Since the human condition generally is freedom, if any of us wants freedom for himself, the only coherent position is to want freedom for everybody. If we're honest, we'll see that existential freedom must lead us to support political freedom. We must struggle for everyone's freedom from economic and political oppression. Sartre doesn't really explain how these two kinds of freedom relate to one another, how your existential freedom, which is a burden, translates into political freedom, which is a positive value for you and others. Sartre just points out that we do often seek our own freedom, and that if we're consistent, we have to seek freedom for others too. Sartre thinks each one of us must choose his own values out of our radical freedom, so he can't prescribe this social ideal for everyone. Still, in this ringing statement, one hears Sartre declaring his own political and social goals. Sartre's telling his Paris audience on this October afternoon in 1945 that pursuing freedom everywhere is to be the basis of his own personal and political actions. He's committing himself to trying to create, in himself at least, the image of a free man, consciously and coherently espousing freedom. He is going to be heard. And he was. Following this famous lecture in the fall of 1945 until his death in 1980, Jean-Paul Sartre was the most politically influential intellectual in France, possibly in the world. He was constantly taking and changing positions, advocating causes, writing essays and manifestos, agitating, protesting, now opposing the communists, now joining with them, now launching out on his own. All this activity was part of a project to express his own freedom and to resist oppression wherever he saw it. He wanted to create what he hoped would be greater freedom and greater openness for self-creation, for the masses. In his zeal, Sartre made many enemies and often alienated his friends. One of these friends, the great social theorist Raymond Aron, described Sartre's passion for a social revolution as romantic, abstract, and rhetorical. Aron exclaimed,
"Sartre ignores the nature of societies, just as he ignores that of men. When this novelist and philosopher concerns himself with politics, he has all the sentimentality of an adolescent. He rejects with contempt the arguments of sociologists and economists refusing to admit that the state of collective resources and the mechanisms of social relations place certain limits on the aspirations of the humanists.
But Sartre persisted. He saw himself engaged in intellectual combat on behalf of human freedom. In addition to his directly political writings, Sartre's entire literary and philosophical labor was also intended to promote greater consciousness of freedom and greater political realization of it. Through all his novels, plays, essays, and treatises, Sartre explores the foundations and forms of human freedom and the limits and threats to it. His thought changes and evolves, but his preoccupation is always there. In what follows, we'll explore this literary and philosophical labor in greater detail. The themes of Jean-Paul Sartre's thinking were apparent very early on. Already as a schoolboy, he'd been struck by what he later came to call contingency. He felt there was a lack of any authoritative sense or meaning to life's events. He noticed this as he began to think about storytelling. Sartre was always writing stories. He and his friends frequently costumed themselves and performed little plays. They spent a lot of time at the movies. Sartre began to reflect on how these stories, plays, and movies were so different from real life. In a narrative, things are linked together. They make sense. People are heroes or villains. But when you get out in the street, there isn't any organizing principle. People just move around. Sartre took from his childhood experience this idea that stories are different from real life, and he built his first and most famous novel around it. This novel, Nausea, was published in 1938, just before World War II. Its central character, Antoine Roquentin, is a writer like Sartre himself. Roquentin is trying to write the history of an obscure diplomat, long dead. Gradually, he comes to realize how impossible it is to tell the man's story without falsifying it. And Roquentin also comes to see that he's falsifying his own life when he tries to think narratively about it. Here's how he puts it.
While you leave, nothing happens. The scenery changes. People come in and go out. That's all. There are no beginnings. Days add on to days without rhyme or reason, an interminable and monotonous addition. But when you tell about a life, everything changes. Only it's a change that nobody notices. The proof is that people talk about true stories, as if there could be true stories. Events take place in one direction, and we tell about them in the opposite direction.
In a story, we reinterpret things. When we start telling a story, we already know the end. We make sense of events by making them lead up to it. Roquentin goes on.
You only seem to start at the beginning. It was a fine autumn evening in 1922. I was a notary's clerk in Marome. But in reality, you have begun at the end. It is there, invisible and present. It lends these few words the pomp and value of a beginning. I was out walking. I had left the town without realizing it. I was thinking about my money troubles. This sentence, taken simply for what it is, means that the fellow was absorbed, morose, 100 miles from an adventure, exactly in the mood to let things happen without noticing them. But the end is there, transforming everything. For us, the fellow is already the hero of the story.
For us, the fellow's already a hero. But for himself, he's just there, walking. That difference is inescapable in storytelling. Roquentin then reflects on his own predicament.
I wanted the moments of my life to follow each other and order themselves like those of a life remembered. I might as well try to catch time by the tail.
Lives are contingent. Lives don't have stories. We give stories to them. Lives don't have meanings. We give meanings to them. We don't live backward. We live forward into the future. By projecting ourselves forward, we give meaning to our present situation and to our past. In terms of what we now think and do, we reinterpret what we then thought and did. But isn't there some sense to events that's independent of the way we interpret them? Sartre thinks not. There's an inevitable gap between story and reality because there's simply no objective reality to stories at all. We need stories, to be sure. We live our lives entirely in terms of them. We try to make sense of what happens to us, of who we are in terms of the stories we find in the society around us. We give ourselves roles and identities within these stories. We're writers or teachers or waiters or pimps, for example. But in the end, we are responsible for the roles we play and the identities we create. This is the force of Sartre's radical view of history and human freedom. Events occur, of course. Like Sartre's character, Roquentin, you do certain things. You fail an exam, maybe. Then you get a job in an ugly provincial town. Then a love affair falls apart. But these are just contingent events, just one damn thing after another. You give meaning to them. You determine your role in relation to those events and the story you tell. You are responsible for your story. We're all hurled toward the future. In each new moment, we choose afresh. We continually choose and re-choose the meaning of what we are and what we've been. Contingency means that events and actions don't have meaning as they occur. We can't live with the meaning of our lives already given to us. Like Roquentin, we can't catch time by the tail. As Roquentin soon discovers, human existence is contingent in quite a different way as well. Roquentin has earlier seen that events in human lives are contingent. They have no essential meaning. He now comes to see that events in the natural world are contingent too. Nature has no built-in story either, no objective character or sense other than what our language and science give to it. For Roquentin, natural beings are just there. Things just happen for no ultimate reason. While sitting in the park one day, Roquentin has a kind of vision. He experiences the stark otherness of nature, its unutterable bare existence, its absurdity. It happens when he finds himself staring at a chestnut tree.
All at once, the veil is torn away. I have understood. I have seen. The roots of the chestnut tree sank into the ground just beneath my bench. I couldn't remember it was a root anymore. Words had vanished, and with them the meanings of things, the ways things are to be used, the feeble points of reference which men have traced on their surface. I was sitting, stooping over, head bowed, alone in front of this black, knotty lamp, entirely raw, frightening me. It took my breath away. Never, up until these last few days, had I suspected the meaning of existence. I was like the others, like the ones walking along the seashore, wearing their spring clothes. I said, like them, the sea is green. That white speck up there is a seagull. But I didn't feel that it existed, or that the seagull was an existing seagull. Usually, existence conceals itself. It is there, around us, in us. It is us. You can't say two words without mentioning it, but you can never touch it. And then, all at once, there it was, clear as day. Existence had suddenly unveiled itself. It had lost the harmless look of an abstract category. It was the dough out of which things were made. This root was kneaded into existence, or rather the root, the park gates, the bench, the patches of grass, all that had vanished. The diversity of things, their individuality, were only an appearance, a veneer. This veneer had melted, leaving soft, monstrous lumps in disorder, naked, with a frightful and obscene nakedness.
Existence hides behind the ways we see it and talk about it. We arrange it into things with names, identities, parts, colors, functions, so forth. But in itself, without us, existence is an undifferentiated mush of meaningless matter. Between our words and things, there's always this gap. Words never get us to concrete existence, but only to generalities. Roquentin reflects that the mysterious root is a pump which takes water up into the trunk of the chestnut tree. Science tells us things like that. But this is only more words. Useful words, maybe, but ultimately, Sartre thinks, they do not and cannot show us what things are in themselves. Words, even verifiable scientific words, give us the world as it relates to us. Existence in itself is indifferent to our familiar categories. It lacks definition or character. It just smooshes on and on, more and more, without end or reason. Roquentin continues.
I realized there was no mean between non-existence and the swooning abundance. If you existed, you had to exist to excess, to the point of moldiness, bloatedness, obscenity. We were a heap of existences, uncomfortable, embarrassed at ourselves. We hadn't the slightest reason to be there. None of us. Each one confused, vaguely alarmed, felt superfluous in relation to the others. Superfluous. It was the only relationship I could establish between these trees, these gates, these stones, and I, myself, soft, weak, obscene, digesting, juggling with dismal thoughts. I, too, was superfluous.
This is the end of part 2. Please download part 3 to continue.